I have guests in the studio, both of whom are fairly regular visitors here to Spokane Public Radio, and we are very glad of that. First of all, one of our most frequent flyers, James Loeb, music director of the Spokane Symphony Orchestra, and another fairly frequent flyer. Notice how I work in that alliteration there.
I love it.
Andrea Olson, music director at the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist on the South Hill. Mm-hmm. Welcome to you both.
Good morning, Jim.
Thank you. Good morning.
And we are going to be having a bit of a chat around a program that's happening this weekend at the Fox Theater. And that would be, of course, in the accustomed spots of 7:30 on Saturday evening and then at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon with a prelude of a presentation by James. And that happens an hour before curtain on both days. So you can go get educated about what you're going to hear and just hear a delightful program that's called Landscapes with, I think, a composer that'll be new to almost everybody. And also some very familiar sounds to close things out. So, James, let's start with you and the inspiration for this program.
Well, I'm fascinated by how music can create a sense of place and time when it's essentially an abstract art form. You know, if it doesn't have words to tell you are right now in Norway or Finland or Spokane, how does music do that? So all the pieces on this program create really brilliantly a sense of place and a landscape within it. So we start with a piece by Hamish McCun, who's a Scottish Victorian composer, very Scottish and very Victorian. And he does it by using this, what is often called a Scotch snap rhythm. I prefer Scottish snap because Scotch comes in a glass, usually single malt with no ice. But this kind of dugum, dugum, backwards, short long rhythm is a very Scottish thing. And so he uses that in his music, and it's got some real kind of outlander feel. There's a bit of a battle going on. So it creates this very romantic view of Scotland. And then we go into Debussy, Prelude à l'après-midi d'enfant, which is the most exquisite dream.
And talk about your contrasts.
Yeah.
Just in all,
I love that.
In all aspects.
Yeah, and I love that. So we then have this... You know, it's a classical, it's a based on a symbolist poem by Mallarmé that is very fruity and French about a fawn, half man, half goat, who wakes up in a Mediterranean hot summer afternoon in a half dreamlike state. And he's dreaming about beautiful nymphs and naiads. And he doesn't quite know if he's awake or asleep. And the way Debussy makes that happen by having these harmonies that never quite resolve and these colours that blend into each other. It's an incredible piece. One of the most important pivotal pieces in all of music, I think. Mm-hmm. Again, it stands right in the junction of romantic music and the 20th century music.
And it's really an iconic piece because, for better or for worse, it's one of those pieces out of the repertoire that has been used for everything. That
right.
It has a kind of ubiquity to it. This piece will not come as a surprise to you, but it should come as a comforting presence, as a familiar and comforting presence.
Yeah, and it has one of the passages that is probably one of my favorite passages in all of music, which is just this most incredible yearning melody with the kind of the winds over the top. Sighing, it's just so perfumed. It's incredible, and you really feel the heat haze in it. And of course, it features one of the most famous openings, which is a flute solo, played by Julia Pike, our phenomenal principal flautist, or flutist. I never quite know whether she plays the flaut or the flute, but let's say flutist.
She was in, and I didn't look at the label on the instrument, so I couldn't tell. I'm no help.
It's the long silver thing, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, so she plays it exquisitely. And as I say, it's just one of the most beautiful, delicate pieces. I absolutely adore it. Great fun to conduct.
And so far, we've had a wonderful contrast between the kind of rugged, outdoorsy Scottish snap, ta-dum, ta-dum, mm-hmm. ta-dum, with the McCun piece into the very lush and tropical and hazy, as you said, the Debussy. Then we are snatched and put up at the Arctic Circle.
That's right. We go from the beauty of the south of France, the kind of Cézanne Monet paintings, to desolation. And actually, it is a beautiful, beautiful desolation. So the composer who has one of the, my favorite composer names of all composers, Eino Juhani Rautavaara.
Well said, thank sir.
You.
Well said.
Kiitos. Thank you. So he's from Finland, as you can probably guess from that very, very long name. So Rautavaara was invited to write a cantata for the graduation ceremony from the University of Oulu in northern Finland. Now, I've actually been to Oulu. I conducted the orchestra there. And when I was there, it was February, and it was 40 below freezing. Mm-hmm. And that, math fans, is where Fahrenheit and centigrade meet.
Together.
Right. Uh-huh. So it's the same. So it was 40 below in both systems. So in both systems, it was really freezing.
And light either.
At that time of year. Yeah, so Oulu sits just below the Arctic Circle. It's like the gateway to the very high north. And Rautavaara thought, well, rather than writing a cantata for solo voices and choir and orchestra, he thought he would actually go out into the tundra and record birdsong. So this is what he does. It's recorded birdsong, most of which is natural. One movement has it manipulated, but the effect is not the kind of bucolic tweeting you might expect. The effect is one of, it feels kind of very distant from humanity because it is up there. Mm-hmm. It's very, very sparsely populated. And so you have this incredible beauty, but a very northern beauty. So it's a total contrast from this kind of perfumed French Riviera feeling. It's mm-hmm. very much this not quite barren landscape, but very beautiful tundra that is almost devoid of humans. And you feel that. And then there is a human element that comes in. There's a few really beautiful melodies that come in under the birdsong. So we have this taped birdsong going alongside the orchestra.
Very different from the other use of birdsong that people are more than likely familiar with in music of Respighi.
Which we closed our last season. Mm-hmm. So yes, that birdsong, the nightingale that comes in the Respighi, is this beautiful, warm and homely thing. You're supposed to feel you're sitting in the pine forest mm-hmm. and you just hear a nightingale. This feeling is very much that you are out in this beautiful wilderness alone mm-hmm. with these incredible bird songs that you just don't hear. It's not something you're going to hear in your back garden in Spokane. So it is an incredibly cleverly constructed piece, but really very, very beautiful. The last movement is Migrating Swans, and of course we have that here. Mm. You know, and if you've ever seen swans, or rather heard swans, gathering on a lake before they migrate, it's this glorious cacophony. Mm-hmm. And he writes this music that builds and builds and builds, and then this incredible melody comes in from underneath it. It's a spine-tingling moment, actually. It's really great. And we have some nice visuals behind the orchestra for this of some or other.
Oh, very good.
Beautiful, misty Finnish landscapes.
Mm-hmm. And then we have our northern bona fides taken care of, which sets us up well for the second half of the concert.
I have always wanted to do the complete Peer Gynt by Edvard Grieg, but it is almost impossible mm-hmm. to stage because it involves a cast of, I don't know, 20 actors, huge choir, soloists, dancers, the whole schmuzzle. And so what we've done with this is we've taken the bulk of the music, which is the two suites and the overture, and we are reordering them to actually go in the story.
Yeah.
And then we have invited two wonderful actors to narrate and act to join these pieces together.
Mm-hmm. And we have one wonderful actor with us here.
Yes.
Andrea Olsen, who is putting on a slightly different hat than...
Yes.
I mean,
literally, in fact.
Literally. Yes, I will be.
And so between the two of you, because I've seen a production only once, and I think that has been ticked off my list mm. of things to do long ago. It's to witness an actual production of Peer Gynt mm-hmm. Is a commitment.
Mm-hmm.
It is very, very long. It's like they once said about the movie Gone with the Wind. It's so long they don't have intermission. They have visiting hours.
And
so...
Nice.
we are getting a much concentrated version of it mm-hmm. here without the choruses. These are all the instrumental suites mm-hmm. from Peer Gynt. So Andrea, tell us how it all works here.
Well, James has sort of boiled down the story and summed it up into dialogue in between or introducing the next movement and giving some kind of context to what's happening, what you're going to hear or what you're hearing at the time. And so along with my co-star, Paul Villabrille, he will be playing the role of Pierre. And I will be sort of, as we said earlier, wearing many hats as the narrator, sort of taking us through the story, but also, when needed, becoming those characters that Pierre interacts with on stage. So Solveig, Asa, his mother, Anitra, the Bedouin chief's daughter, and Ingrid, the bride that he steals away. So through that through line kind of gives the listener an idea of what's going to be happening or what is happening, the things that Pierre or that Grieg tried to set in his music. So lots of earlier on the concert, there's those landscapes and we see those, but now there's a storyline added to that landscape. And so in hopes that I think the audience maybe will get an idea of, oh, yes, this is part of a larger work. Boy, I'd like to see this maybe staged sometime. But also, it's a lot of music. And so what's happening here is very evocative. And if you're creative and you can kind of put yourself in that place and see what's happening in your mind, that's wonderful. But I think this helps the audience sort of get into Ibsen's head a little bit, and Pierre's head quite a bit. So it's been really fun to put it together. So
now, when you are assuming all these different roles, is this done vocally only? Is there a change in your attitude on stage, or as you hinted at, mm-hmm. hat change?
Yes, all of the above, actually.
Oh, okay.
So I've got my work cut out for me as much as possible without detracting, obviously, from what's going on. But yes, most definitely. So it's kind of an actor's repertoire. You know, I turn my head and I'm somebody else, kind of thing. But as many things as possible to make sure that the audience understands who I am at that point, and we've sort of crafted the language a little bit, and blocking, semi blocking mm-hmm. staging, so that it makes sense to the audience. So it's very obvious. Oh, now she is so and so, and now she's back to being the narrator, or trying to. And that was a challenge, I think. You know, we'd spent quite some time talking through that. How is that going to be clear to the audience?
Right. You have spent a lot of time on stage as mm-hmm. as actor, as a singing mm-hmm. actor, as a director, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Is this something, A, that you've done before, done anything like this, or is this a brand new endeavor for you?
This is new as far as this sort of organized
chaos.
Presentation, okay. Organized chaos. but you know, I there was a show a few years ago that I did. I starred in Bright Star, and I had to play myself at 17, and then myself at 35, and I actually had to transform on stage. And so I feel like as long as I'm committed to what that character is, there was even a different gait to my walk, and a different sort of posturing mm-hmm. That made it very clear. Several people said if you hadn't changed on stage, I would have thought it was somebody else. It just, they thought, oh, okay, it'll just be another person, and it wasn't. So embodying that, so for me, the homework is what is this character? And so then when I become Asa, or I become Solveig, who is that? What is their story? And how would they move or speak or act or even just how they would stand? And then the narrator is just Andrea mm-hmm. as a default. But I think, no, I have. So the quick answer is no. This is new. But the long answer is I think that every character that I've done that homework on and studied how to become that person believably. So I feel like it's something that I've kind of been prepping for, you know, all this time. I just am not singing. That's the only kind of difference in this case.
Well, I'm sure that we could contact Edvard Grieg somewhere in the cosmos, and he'd write at least one song for you. I need to say that we are in conversation here with James Lowe of the Spokane Symphony Orchestra and Andrea Olson, who are collaborators and leaders of this program called Landscapes that the Spokane Symphony is doing this weekend, the second of the Masterworks programs. And you're hearing this conversation on SPR Classical. James, a question about Edvard Grieg, perennially popular composer, certainly in terms of the music for Peer Gynt and in the suites that everybody has probably heard, if not the whole thing, then certainly there are bits and pieces, and there's a ubiquity about his music because some snatches have been stolen and used for
Looney Tunes,
various things, among others.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And so what is it about to you? What is it about Grieg's music that makes it so immediately accessible and popular?
I think his music is very, very direct. He is a master of melody, but it's not just the melody. He has a voice. So he's one of those composers, the really great composers. You can hear a piece of theirs you've never heard before and know it's Grieg. And I think that's because it's not just the melodies that are phenomenal, but there's a little harmonic thumbprint he has every now and again. He does delicacy very well. He does nostalgia and a bittersweet thing very well. Also just kind of joy as well. So I think for me, the music is so direct. It's in this sweet spot. You know, it's deeply romantic music. It's warm and heartfelt, but it's very straightforward. And, you know, it's interesting. He didn't really write big, long symphonic movements. You know, he did write a symphony, but and a big piano concerto, obviously, is his most famous work. But I think it's the miniature aspect that he excelled at. When you hear these lyric pieces he wrote for piano, they are exquisite, single one. And I think what is great about Peer Gynt is that it gives him this opportunity for these vignettes. You know, no single piece of music lasts more than 4 or 5 minutes, but together they make this, really create this incredible atmosphere, and they're just exquisitely, beautifully written.
And Andrea, do you find that the music provides you, because now you've had a chance to do this with the orchestra in rehearsal, or is that yet to come?
That's today.
Okay, all right, fine. Maybe you can come back and tell us it. I was just kind of going toward what difference does this make to you as the performer, as the dramatic performer on stage, to actually have an orchestra that you can use your imagination in this and then test it against the reality?
It sort of is, it provides that, the backbone for my decision making. So as I'm listening to things, as I'm practicing and running through in anticipation of being with a live orchestra, I'm hearing like this would be the movement that this character would make. There's this character, the woman in green, and she's the daughter of the troll king, and there's this situation that occurs. I won't give it all away because I want people to come, but there's this situation that occurs between Peer and this woman, and the music sort of just speaks to that. And actually, just as a little sidebar, Ibsen really wanted Grieg to set things, have music that was in the places that they were. So, for example, he traveled to Morocco, and Ibsen said, "I'd like to have music, you know, that sounds Moroccan," and Grieg was like, "No, I want to do the music that's in my head." And so sort of that "to thine own self," one of the through lines in the play, and Ibsen's, you know, words themselves was "to thine own self be true." And I think, okay, trust that instinct. So if the music makes me feel like I want to, not to just be silly about it, but like in the Hall of the Mountain King, and you get that sort of heavy, you know, you want to walk a little heavier. It mm-hmm. sounds, it feels like you should, well, walk like a troll. Whatever that looks like to you, but there gives that heaviness. And so as James was saying, that sort of that lyricality and that melodic sense that Grieg had, it's there. And one of the things that I feel really called to do and I think I do well is listen to the music and do what it's telling me. So the interpretation is right there. The composer has done it. And if he wants, you know, unabashed, you know, bursting in the door, the music sounds like that. And so therefore, I have to honor that. If it's something that's sounding maybe sneaky or timid or ashamed or bashful, the music tells you that. And I do that in my own performances. I do that with my students. And I just say, look, it's right here. You can almost see it in the score. Lots of black dots on the page. Something's happening, right? You know, long, you know, less dots on the page. It tells you what to do. And so for me, I just keep telling myself, okay, this is what I'm hearing. So this character is this and is embodying this emotion. So for me, it comes down to the emotion of what is happening in the music. And I think, again, as James mentioned, Grieg was very good about, you know, basically handing that to you in his score.
And I think there is a genius of Grieg in that he captures the characters so beautifully within seconds. Uh-huh. So at the very end, we have Solveig, who is the pure woman in this entire thing, who waits her entire life for this ne'er-do-well horrible man,
scoundrel
mm-hmm. to come back to her. And there is the music of such delicacy and purity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 20 minutes before, you've had trolls mm-hmm. running through a cave, mm-hmm. wielding axes mm-hmm. up here. And then he's also able to create this music that is just so exquisitely pure and gentle and forgiving. It's really just incredible how with so few notes he can create a character on a page like that. And for me, that's just genius. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It will be a wonderful program, I'm sure. This is most promising stuff, and we're prepared for dress in layers so that when we go from the freezing north to the tropics and then back again, you don't get into any kind of trouble with that. But and your fellow actor again,
Paul Villabrille.
Yeah, Villabrille.
He's a local actor, quite busy. But was also in Bright Star.
All right,
with me as well. So
and joining Andrea Olson, and of course the Spokane Symphony, led by music director James Lowe, the second of the Masterworks programs of this new season. Called Landscapes, and really looking forward to this. And so thank you both for coming by.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
And you've heard that here on the stations of SPR Classical, KSFC, KXJO, and KPBY. We're going to play a little bit from the score for Peer Gynt, music of Edvard Grieg. And forgive me, we're going to start in the obvious place.